Hello and welcome to the book club. It's Rick Croxton and
Art Sippo.
And today we're going to do one of my favorite series, the Weird Heroes from the 1970s. Well, Art, you want to kind of give us a little background on what the series was about?
Well, the Weird Heroes series started out in 77, and it was an attempt to start a kind of a pulp genre type recurring theme paperback series. It was the brainchild of Byron Price, who was a writer, editor, and publisher. Very young man, actually. He had just gotten out of college. He was 5 years out of college when he got this idea. And he was able to get on board a number of very talented people, including Philip Jose Farmer, Ron Goulart, and Ted White, who were all very well known, and a couple of other people who were up and coming, like Marv Wolfman and Ben Bova. In any case, and Arthur Byron Cover, I should mention him as well. They started out Weird Heroes number one in 1977, led off with the Great Heart Silver character, a creation of Philip Jose Farmer, in a story called The Showdown at Shootout. Now, this was an attempt by Farmer to have all of the great villains and all of the great heroes come together in one place for a final Ragnarok-like battle where they would all die, and the only one who would be left was Greatheart Silver, who would carry on the tradition of the pulp heroes. So we had different characters that were pastiches of well-known characters. For example, there was a Doc Ravage. this was during Farmer's period, and he was doing a lot of things that were very, very pulp related. There were 8 issues of Weird Heroes, and they went through till the late 70s, so I think we had several issues a year. Byron Price then carried on the idea into a couple of other collections. One of them was called I, Alien, and the other one was Guts.
Right. Now, I contradict you on the date.
Okay, what's the... I
got the book right here in my hand.
And when did it come out?
It's in October of 75.
75. Well, that's even more interesting, because that means that Price was out of school only 3 years he started producing this.
Yeah, and I've shown like some of these stories that came out earlier, around like 74 and stuff. Like here, The Rose in the Sunshine State, Part 1, is copyrighted in 74. First published in a... I'll spell out the title. It's APHRA magazine.
Afra, yeah.
Feminist literary journal.
Yeah, well, the Rose story, as I remember it, was about an older woman in the Sunshine State who had retired to Florida, and her adventures in the low budget housing in which she was living at that time. It was kind of a very odd thing to put in a pulp magazine, but it was an interesting choice. And Ron Goulart started his Quest of the Gypsies series here, and he continued. He had a couple of other stories in the series. In fact, two of them were full-length novels, actually.
Right.
One was in Weird Heroes number 3 and then Weird Heroes number 7. But, you know, my favorites, you know, the things that I really looked at when I picked these up, there were actually two that I liked in particular. One was, of course, whatever Phil Farmer was writing at the time. I enjoyed everything Phil Farmer did. He had an interesting story in Weird Heroes number 8, the Grant Robeson papers, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in some detail. The other one was Doc Phoenix, who was a character created by Ted White. Now, Ted White was another one of very interesting characters that had wandered into the field. He was a writer. He was a music critic. He was a radio personality as well as being an editor and doing a lot of other things. He also won I believe, a Nebula Award for one of his stories. He did the Kanar series in the 1960s, which I really liked very much. It was an alternate world series. And I thought that it was different from others that existed, since it was going on. This was a character who was living in present time, who was being transported into another world, and it had a lot of the ideas and values of modern times were used in the story. But his Doc Phoenix is Dr. Raymond Phoenix, who was a psychiatrist who entered into people's dreams in order to help them deal with their psychiatric problems. And it was definitely an attempt at a Doc Savage-like character. But eventually Ted White collaborated with Marv Wolfman on a story called The Oz Encounter, which was in the series here. In fact, it was Weird Heroes number 5, was the full-length novel. And that had very recently been reworked and retypeset and published by an outside press. Let me dig it up here.
Well, Hungry
Tiger Press.
You know, we were on one of the groups that I'm on. I don't know if you're on it too. Ted White's on there.
Is that real? Is that true? I didn't know. Which group is he?
I can't remember. You know, I'm in so many different groups, it's kind of hard to keep track.
Yeah.
But he had mentioned, somebody had talked about his Dark Phoenix story, and he had said that that Marv Wolfman completely changed what he had done. So he wasn't exactly happy with what came out of the in the Weird Hero stuff. So what we're reading is more a Marv Wolfman story than an actual Ted White story.
Interesting.
And Doc Phoenix, his first appearance was in the Weird Heroes number 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what kind of want to give is everybody is an idea of what stories were in what the first two. Now, I've got both books right here in my hand. And then we get back to where you're at. Our first one, you had the Gypsy, Guts, Adam Stalker, Greatheart Silver, and Rose. And we'll go over all those in a little bit. And then the second one, you have Doc Phoenix, Cordwainer Bird, Greatheart Silver, Viva, SPV-166, and the Camden Kid. So, and then the other six are, except for number 8, and I believe number 6. Okay, 3, 4, 5, and 7 are just novels of single characters. You know, 1, 2, 6, and 8 are anthologies. And we'll cover the other anthologies in a little bit. But I just want to kind of let people know what's in those first two anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
So, have you found what you're looking for? Or?
Yep. They had republished the story from Weird Heroes number 5, Doc Phoenix, The Oz Encounter. It was done by Hungry Tiger Press. And Hungry Tiger Press specializes in reprinting Oz-related material and some of the original Frank Baum stories that, other than Oz. There's a character called Sammy Steele, who is a kind of adventure character from 100 years ago now. These are stories that were published between 1905 and 1910. I just kind of run across this in researching for the story here. But The Oz Encounter now is in a nice big hardcover volume. And the reason why it was so hot on it in the Hungry Tiger Press is because it is a relatively faithful rendering of some of the Oz-like story characteristics. You know, Dorothy is involved and several of the other characters, like the Scarecrow and that. Though in a slightly bent form, because these are the characters as imagined by a psychologically disturbed little girl, and they help to flesh out her psychopathology. So this is, a fairly interesting story. And I have to admit, I really enjoyed the Doc Phoenix stories. I was somewhat disappointed that they weren't more Doc Savage-like.
Oh yeah.
Because you know I was and am a big Doc Savage fanatic, but I thought that they were interesting stories, and the character of Doc Phoenix was well rendered. Now the other materials that we had in Weird Heroes were attempts to bring up pulpy kind of characters, you know, to resurrect that same kind of spirit that you had in the 1930s in all of the science fiction magazines. You know, during this period in the 1970s, there was a lot of the science fiction material had become somewhat ponderous. We had not quite gotten into the heavy space opera stuff that we're dealing with now, and that has been around for a while. We're starting to see the shift back, I think, to more character-driven sci-fi stuff. But there are still a lot of these heavy space opera series which involved a lot of investment of time and mind in them, and it's kind of hard to come into the middle of the series because there's so much that's gone before. But these were more intended to be you know, lighthearted romps. I wouldn't say not lighthearted in the sense of being you know, things that won't grab you, but more in terms of stories that you can get into now and get into the flow of. But you know, Byron Price, sadly, Byron passed away back in 2005. I always get worried about this when I see something like this because he and I were the same age. But when younger people than I are passing away, it reminds me of my own mortality, but we're not going to go there.
Well, one of the things I've read about the series, it's supposed to be a combination of pulps and comics.
Mm-hmm.
As to both. And if you start looking at the names of the people who contribute to this, you know, you have, okay, right here on cover number one, the stories and graphics. You got Philip A. Farmer, Archie Goodwin, Ron Goulart, Joanne Cobin, K-O-B-I-N, Ian Pris, Sonako, I never get his name right, Jeff Jones, I'm thinking of John. Jeff Jones, Alex Nino, Sutton, Sheridan. Then there's an introductory conversation by Fritz Lieber. And then you go to the second one. You got, I'll just read off the ones that weren't mentioned in the first one. Harlan Ellison, Ted White, Steve Englehart, Elliot S. Megan, Swift. See, Adams, which one Adams was that? Did this get Neil Adams, or is it? Yeah, Neil Adams. Reese, Fabian. I mean, you got some of the big names of science fiction and comic books in these series.
Well, you know, Marv Wolfman, who was involved with the second Doc Phoenix story, the novel in Weird Heroes number 5, he was big in comics in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, he's not a lightweight at all. I think he, was he in the, like, the Crisis series?
Yes, he's the one who, he wrote Crisis like Infinite Earths. Back in the 70s, he wrote the Tomb of Dracula, for Marvel Comics. You know, during this time, he would have been really big in Marvel Comics at that time.
Yeah, and I think I'm seeing here too. He did the new Teen Titans.
Exactly.
He's the one that's responsible for the new set of characters that came in. So he's you know, Marv is not a lightweight at all. And yeah, I think that was probably he had one of his bigger breaks when he got involved with the Weird Hero storyline. He was also apparently I'm looking here on the website. He was a protege of Roy Thomas over at Marvel.
Right. Now, also, if you notice that the Marvel Hero series, that came out in the 80s, he was one of the editors, and he wrote a couple of the novels in that series. There's like 11 books came out in that series when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky to have all 11 of them. You know, not all of them were great, but hey, at that time, I was happy to get anything. But that's a little bit later on, past this right here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm also seeing over here that there was a dispute back 10 years ago, well, actually 12 years ago now, between Mr. Wolfman and Marvel Comics over the character Blade.
Right.
When the movie came out with Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, because Marv Wolfman had created the character in the Tomb of Dracula. And, of course, you know, Marvel's going to be saying it's the, right for hire, work for hire.
Mm-hmm.
Probably what they was using. And like I said, he had created the character, and at the time, it was popular, but they didn't know it was going to be as popular and as money-making as it became.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is always a problem with intellectual property. It used to be, back in very early days, that the guy who thought up something was privileged to keep the rights to it. But as time has gone on, corporations have started to try and get control of whatever is designed under their auspices or, what they're paying for. This intellectual property question has become a big issue for people who have done comics over the last, since 1960. So that's a mere 50 years ago.
Oh,
when
the
Fantastic Four first came out.
With Superman.
Yeah, the Superman. The Superman case is a case in point with,
Schuster.
Schuster and Siegel and Schuster. That became an issue. It was an issue too. Something that's not quite related to our area, but the Three Stooges, with all the work that they did, they actually had no rights to any of the material that they had done on film. And it was because of that, as that was one of the main reasons why there was an impetus to change the laws, to give the actors and the characters rights to residuals from material that they had done. This kind of thing is going to go on. I know it was kind of murky as to what was happening in the 1970s and 80s with regard to this, when there was an explosion of new ideas in comics. And we're starting to see this. This case with Mr. Wolfman is a case in point. The Siegel and Schuster case goes back even further. Intellectual property is a hot topic right now. And I think there's a lot of reasons why some material has not made it into other media is because of this conflict. When it came to the Doc Savage stories, the Doc Savage literary character was owned by Condé Nast, but for reasons that were not entirely clear, the right to make films based on Doc Savage had gone to Lester Dent and it passed to his wife Norma. So this was one of the things that Will Murray had helped to negotiate when they were trying to make the film. Now, one of the reasons why they probably didn't have a Doc Savage film sooner was because of this problem. If you remember, back around 1968 or so, they were planning to do a Doc Savage film with Chuck Connors.
Okay.
And he actually went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and announced this. They did a comic book for Gold Key, which basically looked like it was the storyboard for the movie. But the reason why that all fell apart was because when they went through the papers, they found out that Condé Nast didn't have the right to the film rights. So that's interesting. Anyway, we're getting far afield again. We tend to do that on occasion.
Nah, not too
far. Not us.
But, what gets to me is the first two books are what you would call sort of introductions to the characters that they're going to be doing.
Yeah, I should say something about Cordwainer Bird.
Okay.
Okay, because actually they have the story, that Cordwainer Bird story was not done by Harlan Ellison, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Right? Look on the story.
I'm doing right now. Let's see. Hardware. Yeah, he did.
It is by him.
It's by Harlan Ellison. By Neil Adams.
Okay, because let me tell you a story about Cordwainer Bird. Harlan Ellison had been working in television and radio for a long, long time. And as usual, you get a story idea, and it's a wonderful idea. They love it. They buy it. And then they give it to these sub-writers and these other fellas and these directors who take the story and change it out of context and start, you know, bending and twisting it. And Harlan Ellison, when he was not satisfied with what they had done with one of his scripts, he would refuse to allow them to use his real name. He would use the nom de plume of Cordwainer Bird.
And Cordwainer Smith?
Well, Cordwainer Smith was another science fiction author from late 40s, early 50s. And that's probably where he got the idea.
Yeah, I think they even mentioned in this series.
Yeah, they mentioned that in the beginning. There's an introduction, I think, to the story where it talks about that. When I found out about this after reading this, I was watching some reruns of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And it came up there, you know, writer Cordwainer Bird. So I immediately knew Harlan Ellison had the idea, but he wasn't happy with the way they carried it out. So this Cordwainer Bird character then was intended to be a pastiche of angst and anger over mediocrity.
Okay.
And that's kind of where the story goes. You know, whenever if you're ever watching any of the old television programs and you see the name Cordwainer Bird, you know immediately it was a Harlan Ellison story that had been altered.
There we go. That way it makes you kind of wonder what the original was. Didn't they do a Star Trek?
Yes, Harlan Ellison had done the script for a Star Trek episode. This is the one, and I'm
City on the Edge of Tomorrow?
What was it?
The City on the Edge of Tomorrow?
City on the Edge of Forever. Okay, that was his original story. And he had submitted that story to the Emmy Committee, I believe it was. And they had judged the story worthy of some prize. But in fact, the story itself had not been filmed the way he had intended. They had changed the story rather dramatically for reasons that I think were understandable. Part of it was that they didn't want to have the story's main line had been that there was actually drug dealing on the Starship Enterprise, and Gene Roddenberry didn't want to have anybody think that in the future drugs were going to be a problem. So he had changed the storyline, and that had gotten Harlan Ellison somewhat upset. But Harlan, he's an old war horse. He also is very provocative, and he speaks his mind.
Oh, yeah.
And he sometimes probably tends to speak his mind a little too loudly. As I said, I don't know whether... Did you ever watch Sci-Fi Buzz on the Sci-Fi Channel?
I used to.
Yes. Harlan Ellison did commentary on there.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember a few of those.
Yeah, and he's an old curmudgeon. He was an old curmudgeon back in the early 90s. He's still an old curmudgeon today. I mean, he was a young curmudgeon. But this Cordwainer Bird story was an attempt on his part to flesh out, you know, what he conceived of as the Cordwainer Bird character, who was an angry person who was not going to stand still for mediocrity.
Okay. Well, there's another one. Let's see, the Adam Stalker. Remember that one? Let's see, it was Archie Goodwin had did that one. It's called the Dark Star File. And he is a Vietnam vet turned undercover hero. And a lot of people kind of considered him kind of they call him the long-haired hippie. And all. And the reason why he had such long hair was to cover the scars of his ears that weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that one. Unfortunately, Archie Goodwin is no longer with us. He's been gone for quite a few years now.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He, I think he died at least 10 or 15 years ago. He was well known back to his, back in the 94 thereabouts. He did the 0 Hour series. I got the 0 Month poster. It's autographed by him. And he was really big in the comics.
Hmm.
I mean, that was a really nice one right there. But like I said, it was one of my favorite ones. Along with, you know, the Great Heart Silver, of course.
Oh yeah. Well, the Great Heart Silver was another one of Phil Farmer's provocative characters. At this period in time, Phil was very much into genealogies, and the Great Heart Silver character was intended to be a descendant of Thomas Jefferson through his slave. What was her name?
Oh,
Sally. Gosh, Sally Hemings.
Okay,
Sally Hemings, and so he was supposedly of mixed blood. You know, it should be noted that when Phil Farmer did his biography on Tarzan, he did have one of Tarzan's ancestors being a woman of African descent.
Okay,
so Tarzan came by his African roots honestly, if you will. He had a very detailed genealogy for Great Heart Silver. You know, part of the storyline is about these portraits that are family heirlooms that Silver brings with him. And he apparently was an airship commander sometime in the near future at that time. And the airship crashed and he lost a leg, and so he has a prosthetic leg. And the person responsible for this was a former agent of the U.S. government, a pilot and spy from World War I, which I think was intended to be modeled on G8. But at that time, he had assumed the nom de plume, the Mad Fokker, for the Fokker airplane, but as one can imagine with Phil Farmer, he had a whole other meaning for that word in mind.
Yeah, I just want to say it's very... if you're not careful how you say it.
Right. But that was, that was part of Phil's peculiar charm.
Well, I said, I think we covered, most of the ones. Let's see, now, what else did we have not? Okay, let me read this first page on Weird Heroes 1.
Okay.
Kind of the introduction. This is, in the 1930s, the old American pulps gave their readers Sam Spade, Doc Savage, The Shadow, Captain Future, and The Lone Ranger. Now in the 1970s, this new American pulp brings together 10 of the most popular writers and artists in the field of popular fiction. Their goal, to produce 5 of the most exciting, most incredible, most outrageous characters you've ever seen. And it goes, Weird Heroes Volume 1. So, I mean... It's got a lot of art in it too. I mean, kind of similar to the old pulps, where you get like a page or so every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one that we haven't mentioned or talked that much, is the here we go, The Gypsy, which is Ron Goulart. It's the very first story. And he appears here in the very first story. He also appears in the number 3, which is the number 3 volume, which is Quest of the Gypsy. And in the number 7, which is The Eye of the Vulture. And Gypsy is a unusual character. It's set kind of like in the future. And it's... one of those, this one you think you got them figured out, Ron Goulart changes it. Yeah. He's a guy who does not have his memory's gone. And he has his vulture as a sidekick, you might say. It's very weird. I think that might have been my introduction, one of my earliest introductions to Ron Goulart. And it kind of got me hooked on him. like we was talking before we started recording, I got like a shelf of nothing but his books. If I see his name, I'd buy it. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go through the list of stories and we can kind of make little comments on them. Next one is Stalker, The Dark Star File, which we just mentioned a little bit ago, by Archie Goodwin. Oh, yeah, the Gypsy. It's illustrated by Alex Nino. Stalker is by Archie Goodwin and illustrated by David Sheridan. I'm not really that familiar with that name, are you?
David Sheridan, no. I think Nino was another guy who went into comics and did well.
He was very well-known in comics back then. Mm-hmm. Now, our next one is Guts. Do you remember that story?
I have to admit I don't recall it.
Okay, probably if I jog your memory a little bit, is Guts is by Byron Press and illustrated by the great one, Steranko. One of these days I'll get it right.
Right.
And Guts is a guy who's a big fan of the 1950s, and he's a time traveler. And his plans were to go back into the 1950s. And you look at him, he is a 1950s greaser type. By that, we mean the slick back hair, the Fonzie look. And we're probably dating ourselves by saying that.
But that would have been right for the time period.
Right. Unfortunately, he ends up in the 1970s. So he sort of sticks out. He's had that story, then he had the novel Guts, which Gray Morrow and Michael Golden do the artwork in that one. Now, our next story is The Rose in the Sunshine State by Joanne Cobin, K-O-B-I-N, and it's illustrated by Jeff Jones, which is another great, great artist.
That was kind of an unusual story in that particular series,
right?
Because she was not a this is a pulp heroes kind of thing, and the protagonist in the story is Rose, who is an older woman who's living in a retirement community in Florida in an apartment building, and they're trying to organize against the landlord. She has her daughter actually comes and stays with her, and Rose is quite concerned about, what her daughter is doing and how well she is getting along. But they mention it. In fact, you've got the book there in front of you. They mention that this is an odd kind of character, but they were trying to do something different here.
Right. Yeah, they got the table of contents. They got the pages kind of wrong.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, they say page 135. Well, 135 is still on the old story of Guts. Not finished it. Well, actually, 139, I believe, is it. Yeah, I think 139 is. Let me go to it. 137. Yeah, 139 starts instead of 135. And it's like, it's unusual. And plus an unusual pairing too. But to go on to the next one is the Minstrel of Lankmar, L-A-N-K-H-M-A-R. I discussed it with Fritz Lieber.
Yes.
And Fritz Lieber is a very, very, very well-known swords and sorcery type writer.
Yeah, he was the writer for Fafhrr and the Grey Mouser, if I remember.
Oh, yes. Great series. I remember when I was first introduced to them. In fact, we were kind of mentioning the comic where I was introduced was in Wonder Woman, back when she was kind of looking at her Emma Peel style, back in the 70s. I don't know if you remember that. That's the first time I ever heard of them. Then they had like a 5-issue series. And then I found out later on there was paperbacks out on them. Surprise, surprise. Then, of course, the last one in Volume 1 is Greatheart Silver, showdown at the shootout. And there, you know, it's filmed by the farmer and illustrated by Tom Sutton. And, of course, Tom Sutton is another comic book artist. I can, you know, I know the name, I just can't, recall what it was he did. I'm pretty sure he's Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably mistaken. Didn't he do something with the Punisher?
You know, that might, yeah, you might be right. Might be right, because I know that name.
I do too. Well, we'll go ahead and hit the next one. Yeah, I'll pretty much do the same thing we just did here. Okay, your first one is Doc Phoenix by Ted White and illustrated by Stephen Fabian, F-A-B-I-A-N.
Right.
Comic book artist. I'm pretty sure he did a lot of Marvel, if I remember right. Your next one is Quarterman and Bird in the New York Review of Bird. And here we got two big names, Harlan Ellison and Neil Adams. There's a combination.
Mm-hmm.
We won't go into that.
Yeah.
We get ourselves in trouble with that one. Okay. Then we have the Camden Kid. He's a, from what they say, it's a modern Western. It's by Charlie Swift and illustrated by Steranko.
Uh-huh.
And sorry if I got your name wrong, I apologize. But that's just reading it. That's worthwhile reading just for the art. Okay, I'm gonna flip over there real quick. Oh yeah. Oh, right here. A full page. Of that, oh, that's worthwhile reading just for that one page. Just for his, you know, doing that one little page of art. And it's the character. And that's all that, I mean, you get that and the title, The Camden Kid. But, okay, after that is Viva. Let's see. And that's by Stephen Englehart. Now here we go. It's a reversal. Stephen Englehart is well known in comic books. He's done Batman. He's done, if I remember, he's doing the Defenders in Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few other stuff. He's a very well known comic book writer. The artist is illustrated by Esteban Maroto, M-A-R-O-T-O.
Maroto. Hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't really recognize that name. I guess if I would really get in there, I probably recognize.
Yeah, I don't recognize it either.
Now, coming up, the next one is SPV-166, The Underground Express. And it is done by another comic book writer, Elliot Magan. He's very well known. Superman. And illustrated by Ralph Reis and Paul, I'm just going to spell it out, K-I-R-C-H-N-E-R. Ralph Reis, the name does sound familiar. And the other guy, I'm not familiar with. And, of course, our last story, I believe you heard of this one, The Return of Greatheart Silver.
Right.
By Philip Jose Farmer and illustrated by Tom Sutton.
Hmm.
There, I mean, if all they did was just those two novels, the anthologies, it, you know, it'd be a great series right there. But, actually, it's introduction stuff. And I remember, the first time I saw the, Weird Heroes, you know, number one, I was at a library over in Springdale, Arkansas, and I believe it was a senior in high school. And I just picked it up and said, oh, hey, cool. It's supposed to be on the very first one. It says, beginning an exciting new concept in science fiction and adventure, Weird Heroes, a new American pulp. And you have a sort of a combination of, one, two, three, four different people as one person, the look.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, you had Doc Phoenix, the head.
Right.
Five different ones. It looks like the collar and scarf of Bret Hart Silver. Then the other three are from the other characters, I believe. That's just my theory on that. But, I mean, you can look at the very first one. I don't know if you had the... Now, these are available in new printings. I remember seeing a new printing of number one and two.
Oh, they did two. I knew they did. Had done a new printing of one, but I had not seen the new printing of two.
I could be mistaken on two, but I know it's at least one.
Yeah.
And I can tell you right now, trying to pick up these books, they're going to cost you. It's not going to be cheap. And they are hard to find. I haven't got lucky and got some really nice copies. I had them for years, and I wanted to upgrade them some. And I've been working on it. I still have a couple more I wanted, make a little better copies. But to go on, your volume 3 is the Quest of the Gypsy, and it's got Ron Goulart. And graphics by Alex Nino. And I said, it's got a bit of art in this one. Not a whole lot. I mean, you've got a few pages here and there. And, of course, like I said, Ron Goulart's one of my favorite writers. It's right here on the very first page. The year, I'll give the introduction right here. The year is 2033. Cyborgs roam the streets of the plague-struck London. Robots move insanely amid the ruins of plastic. Okay, I'll let you get this word. L-O-U-V-R-E.
Louvre.
Okay.
A plastic Louvre. The Louvre.
Right.
That's the museum in Paris.
Okay. I kind of thought that was Paris.
Yeah.
I never could figure out that word. It is beneath Gibraltar is a mile-deep complex of secret data sits silently waiting. It's an inter-gypsy, a strange and haunted warrior with surprising teleportive abilities, taunted by stark recurring images of a long-abandoned past. He struggles to find the keys to a 55-year-old puzzle. And the vulture, the weird winged nemesis who is but the first creature to yield clues to Gypsy's true identity. Who is Gypsy? Join in an exciting adventure where you have a chance to outguess the hero. And through the whole thing, he's trying to figure out who he is. And like I said, it's very unusual. And like I said, once you figure it out, Goulart changes the character. But he does play by the rules on it.
He telegraphs what he's going to do.
It's like, it surprises you too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to do a major change like that, what you have to do is you got to set it up so that all of a sudden it clicks and it makes sense. And Ron... Ron's an old master. He's done this kind of thing for a long time.
Now, number four, I believe you said you never have read number four.
No, I haven't.
Okay. Number four is what I don't think was ever mentioned in any other of the series. It's called Magic and Madness Nightshade. And it's a novel by Meacham and King. Illustrated by Rudy Nevres, N-E-V-R-E-S. Unfortunately, I've never, trying to find out, get a full, Tappan King and Beth Meacham, based on a character by Mark Arnold. And the Nightshade is a female, if you look at it, you think of Doctor Strange. On the cover, it's kind of got a really occult feel to it. You have one woman in silver hair with a long blue jumpsuit with a red cape kind of similar to Doctor Strange. And next to her is a kind of a light bluish hair with a light, you know, she's wearing a light blue, more form-fitting jumpsuit. Okay, here we go. Here's a little introduction on the back cover. Internationally famous magician, a voodoo legend in the backfields of Haiti, an obsessed creature of the night. These are about three faces of the haunting, beautiful enigma called Nightshade. Experience her in Terror, Inc., a debut novel by Beth Meacham and Tappan, T-A-P-P-A-N, King. I've never heard of these people before, and the novel and everything was okay. It's 1976. Oh, okay. I'm going to really check. Okay, this Shallow Speaks. An introduction by Walter Gibson is in this thing.
Ah, okay.
That is worthwhile buying the book just by itself. Got two, 3-page introduction by Gibson. Since we are privileged to present this new introduction by the Dean of American Pulp Writers, and incidentally, one of the oldest living and most respected magicians in the world. Colleague of Houdini, author of The Shadow, this piece by Walter Gibson is a rare Weird Heroes treasure. Okay, that's just worthwhile in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Gibson. But, I've only read this once, and it's been years ago, so I couldn't really give you an idea what the story is. But it does have a 70s look to it, if you look at some of the artwork and everything. Alright, so we go on to the next one, which is, you said it's one of your favorite books, The Dark Phoenix. And it says the Ted White, Marv Wolfman. And this is the Oz Encounter.
Yeah, this was, you know, the little girl who has the she is mentally disturbed, and she has these recurring dreams. She's a fanatic about reading the Oz stories, and Doc Phoenix has to enter her dreams with her in order to piece together the story. Meanwhile, on the outside, there's all kinds of things happening. So this is a story that goes on both in the dreams and outside of it. And there's quite a lot of action going on externally, which was unusual. The first Doc Phoenix book was a little bit more, I'm going to use the word reservedly, cerebral. This one had a little bit more action to it, and that's probably the input that Marv Wolfman put into it.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, the ideas were interesting, and I have to admit, at this particular time, I was, this is when I was in medical school, let's see, this is, what year was that now, that was published?
Okay, let me look here. This is done in, okay, published in January of 77.
Yeah, so that would have been, you know, when I was a junior in med school, so it was all very interesting.
I was a junior, junior in high school.
Yeah.
No, I was in junior in high school. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, that was a very interesting story, because he was dealing with some of these psychiatric illnesses and how you get in and deal with them.
Well, okay. We'll go on to number 6. There's another one that I don't believe that you have read yet. Have you? At the end. It has the, I'll go ahead and read out the ones that there's in there.
Yeah.
Shinbet? S-H-I-N-B-E-T?
Right. Shinbet Investigates, another Rod Goulart story.
Right. You got Goulart, Potts, and Austin.
Right. And then that also in there is the Orion story.
Right.
Which belongs to Ben Bova.
And Russell.
Right. Now, Orion was a recurring character that Ben Bova has played with, really for 30 years.
Huh.
This actually, he started it in here. I'm not sure whether this is the first time. If you look at the book, you may see whether it's republished or not. But I suspect that this is probably the first outing on Orion. Orion is an eternal hero type character.
Okay, I'm looking over here and all this stuff here. 77 artwork. The character Shin Bet in 77, Byron. Kara Potts. Okay, I knew that was Kara Potts is a I believe a Punisher artist. Sooner or later I'll get him right. I'll get somebody who's done the Punisher. But I'm not seeing anything else mentioning about that. So it might be his first appearance. On the back cover it says from the pen of Ben Vova. A classic fantasy combining mythic fiction with hard science fiction. And the illustrations by Craig Russell, another great comic book artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, you've been getting them right there in order. You want to try for the next one?
Yeah, well, the next story there is 50 Years of Heroes, the Edmund Hamilton Papers.
And do you have that in front of you?
I do not have that one in front of me, no.
Oh, you just have it on my memory?
Well, no, I've got the Wikipedia article up.
Okay, I'm going to say that to him.
I'm cheating.
I was so impressed, like, wow, you know.
Yeah, he just knows these articles. No, no. But that's one that I had not gotten. And, you know, Edmund Hamilton, he was the author of the Captain Future series.
Right.
He actually was married to Lee Brackett, who was another great science fiction author from the 1940s and 50s. And this would have been an interesting story, 50 Years of Heroes, the Edmund Hamilton Papers. I guess you've got it in front of you. What is it like?
Oh, okay. Well, you got a picture of him on the first part of it. If that's after. Okay, here we go. Big old smiling picture, like almost a politician look. Then on the introduction, it says the 50 Years of Heroes, Edmund Hamilton Papers, a memoir with supplementary material by Julia Schwartz, Forrest Ackerman, and Robert Block, and illustrations by Alex Nino. Oh, that is a gorgeous Nino piece of artwork. Very science fiction. Also, they have a cover from Fantastic Story. Let's see. It's a little too small print for me to figure out without reading the story itself. Oh, I'm going to say the artwork will blow you away. I mean, it's like they go artwork, then cover. The next one, the cover, is a Captain Future.
Mm. Oh, those Captain Future covers are terrific. Look, I want to interject. Are you a fan at all of the TV show The Big Bang?
Oh, yeah. My wife and I just watched the last one.
If you notice in several of them, I don't recall seeing it in any of the recent stories, but they have a big Captain Future poster. It's very prominent in the apartment.
Okay, I have to look for it next time.
Yeah, gotta look. Oh yeah. Yeah, Captain Future was Doc Savage in space.
Right.
Very definitely a Doc Savage pastiche in space. But it was always fun. That was another one of those series that I discovered when they started reprinting the pulps in the late 70s. And I was always so disappointed because they only republished about 8 or 9 of the 20-some-odd Captain Future stories. You know, since that time, they are now reprinting them all. And some of them are actually available online in France, of all places. There's a French website that has several of the stories in electronic format.
Well, I got lucky, and I picked up a handful of the Captain Future paperbacks. In City. And you said they only did, on the paperbacks, what, about 8?
Yeah, like 8 or 9, I think, maybe 10.
So I might have them all.
Well, that's very good. Yeah, the problem is these stories, these were old. I'm trying to remember. Dell was the publisher, if I remember correctly, on them. And these were done with the very cheapest materials imaginable. They haven't aged well. My collection has not aged very well with time. But I've been able to convert some of them to an electronic format so that I still have the storylines. So, you know, it's not a total loss.
I just now went over there and picked up my Edmund Hamilton paperbacks. And I've got one, two, three, four, five, six of his books. Calling Captain Future, Captain Future's Challenge, The Magician of Mars. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I said Captain Future. Oh, this Quest Beyond the Stars, beautiful cover. Reminds me a little bit of Frazetta, almost.
Yeah, I think Frazetta did a couple of those covers, actually.
The Outlaws of the Moon, and The Outlaw World. I don't know if that's a Captain Future or not, but...
The Outlaw World is, yes. That is.
Oh, all six are Captain Futures, huh? Okay, cool.
Now, some of the stories were done by other people. Manly Wade Wellman did a story, and they used a house name called Brett Sterling, which I think was a pseudonym for whatever reason. You know, they were big into house names in those days. But Edmund Hamilton was also the hand behind the initial Legion of Superheroes run that started in 58 and ran through to the mid-60s. And I never knew that, and I only learned about that in recent years. And it kind of surprised me because I had always loved the Captain Future stories, even though it is very obvious that Mr. Hamilton knew absolutely nothing about physics whatsoever.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was he was really bad when it came to the physics in the stories. But the stories were always a lot of fun. They were very imaginative. And I should have been able to link up some similar themes in the stories between him and this Legion of Superheroes. Because as I look back on it now, there were some clues in there that should have clued me in. You know, also, when you go back now, I noticed that they did have some written bylines in some of the stories, though not all.
Right. Now, I do have a question on Captain Future. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of order you should read them in, or is it just sort of done in one? Or does it really matter?
Well, the very first one is Captain Future and the Space Emperor.
Okay.
That's the very first story, and that probably is the best introductory story because it gives you a short vignette on the history leading from the present time period, which at that time was about 1940, up until Captain Future. Interestingly enough, they had the Captain Future character was born like in 1970 and was raised on the moon by his three comrades, the robot Grog, the android Otho, and Simon Wright, the brain, who lives inside this bubble. He's a disembodied brain because his body had some disease, and so Captain Future's father had actually translated his brain into this bubble. And he is trained to be, super intelligent, strong like Grog, agile like Otho, and smart like the brain. It's a fun story. That's really the first one to go. Other than, with the novel-length stories, probably the order doesn't matter so much. I will say that the Magician of Mars is an important story. I believe that character is a repeating character.
Okay.
He's a first appearance in the Magician of Mars, and it's mentioned in other stories. There is a story where they go off into to find the origin of the human race. Now, I should back up. The Captain Future universe is a very different place from what we have. In the Captain Future solar system, there is a planet inside the orbit of Mercury called Vulcan.
Oh.
It's a hollow ball, actually. Okay. And the reason why it's there is that there was a concern in the 19th century that there was indeed a planet inside the orbit of Mercury. because this planet had allegedly been seen numerous times by astronomers. What we now think was going on is that these were near-Earth asteroids that had passed within the orbits of the inner planets, and that may have confused people. Because they would see this planet very close to, or they see this object very close to the sun, and it would not be in the place they would have expected for Mercury. In fact, I have a book about this up in my library. So the planet Vulcan was actually one of those mystery things that had been postulated in this time frame.
So, I mean, he would have probably people on Mercury itself, wouldn't he?
Yes. All the planets in the Captain Future solar system have solid surfaces. All the planets in the Captain Future solar system have life. All of them have a variation of human life.
Okay.
And it's also true that the Earth is a very different place in Captain Future's world than it is here. There have been a number of earthquakes in the 2010s and 2020s, which reshaped the face of the Earth. Part of Africa has come off. A land bridge is built up between Alaska and Siberia, and a variety of other things. The Earth in his day is geologically unstable. And eventually, as a result of that, Captain Future and his crew actually invent a new planet they call Futuria to take the overflow of the populations of the Earth and of other planets. And their big battle is to, they're trying to create a stable planet and believe they have it between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Other things that are interesting about the Captain Future solar system is that there were at least two different pre-human races that were in the solar system at least a billion years ago and had reshaped the solar system. And that might explain the reason why there are solid surfaces on all the gas giant planets in that, because they actually had done this. One of them, the Kanga, are not well known. The other one, I'm blanking on the name of them now, are amoeboid-like beings, very much like Shoggoths from H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay.
In any case, the Shoggothy amoeba-like creatures actually escaped to another galaxy. They ended up in the galaxy and Andromeda. And in one of the stories, Captain Future and his men bring one of them back from there. Now, you noticed I said that all of the planets in the Captain Future solar system have got humans on them.
Right.
Right? Some variation of the human race. The origin of the human race in one of the stories is supposedly a planet called Kanar that is occupying the space between Mars and Jupiter and is destroyed about 65, 70 million years ago. And the remnant of the planet, when it's destroyed, fell into Jupiter and caused the red spot.
Okay.
Okay. And this planet was really the origin of all the human life in the solar system, including the human life on Earth. That had been the beginning. But then we find out that Kanar itself had been colonized by humans from a planet around the star Deneb. And Captain Future, in one of the stories, goes back to Deneb in order to, you know, come to the foundation of human life. And when he gets there, he finds that the human beings had not actually originated on Deneb, but had originated in the Andromeda Galaxy.
Okay, to get an idea of the science of Edmund Hamilton's Captain Future, is if I was go to the 1960s cartoons, like the Herculoids or Space Ghost, and was to follow that, I would have no problem following a Captain Future science.
Yes.
Because people can actually go out in space and have conversations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, part of the problem is that Hamilton doesn't quite get the idea of galaxies down until later in the series. He also doesn't quite understand the limit of the speed of light and why you can't go faster than that. And a couple of other things, you know, about, he doesn't understand about escape velocities. You know, he has, Future doing some rather fantastic and utterly impossible things, trying to escape from traps. So it's a lot of times, Star Trek has done similar things where they have, you know, they've played fast and loose with physics, but at least they had the good sense to say that, you know, well, Einstein is passé in their day. He didn't really know as much. We know better now. And Larry Niven has done the same thing in his Known Space series. Now, he's played a little fast and loose with the physics, but that's okay because he's talking. He's got non-Newtonian systems and other advanced concepts that are beyond our current physical understanding. But anyway, as the thing I want to point out with the Captain Future solar system is that it is very definitely not ours. It's full of life. There's life even on asteroids. And there's a lot of Lovecraftian elements to this. Okay? You have ancient races that have been here, that have come from outer space and come to the solar system and changed it and then gone off again. They have spread, human beings have spread among the different planets, and they're all different kinds. And you know, this was a very elaborate place, and it was a fun place to play around in.
Basically, if you're a diehard, hard science fiction, it wouldn't be the series that you want to get into.
Well, you know, it'd be, you know, for somebody like that, it'd be like reading a fairy tale.
Yeah, so this one here would be more like, if you just want something kind of light.
Yeah.
And fun.
Oh, and it's absolutely entertaining, a joy to read, so much imagination. You know, he has, well, one of the other things he kind of screws up a little bit is he has comets as electrically charged bodies traveling through the solar system, which they really are. But he has an awful lot of fun. They, you know, they are great stories. I still love them. I still read them. Even though I know, you know, I remember sitting there in my bedroom in 1967 reading this Captain Future story and realizing, oh, wow, this is definitely not our solar system, but it doesn't matter.
I remember one guy commenting, you know, whenever something's going wrong, he says, "What? Go back to your old, you know, B movie science fiction movies. Reverse the polarity. That fixes everything."
Right.
You know, listen to, I mean, if you listen to some of the Star Trek, I just reversed the polarity on the ship and that would take care of it.
Yeah, that always works. Everybody
yeah, knows. What do I know? I never was good in science. You know, math was one of my better subjects. Mythology, English was, Science, forget that.
Yeah, but all the Captain Future stuff, this is classic space, this is classic fun space stuff. This is, you know, you're not going to get, nobody's going to give you a degree based on your study of Captain Future's solar system.
Okay.
But you'll have a ball with it, and you know, I highly recommend them. In fact, Ed Hamilton was one of the science fiction writers who was invited when they were doing the moon launches. He was one of them who was invited to the Cape as a special guest for some of the launches. You know, Robert Heinlein had been invited down, and they had invited him as well. And he was apparently he was very well thought of in the field. He was a very nice man. He and Lee Brackett had been married forever, since the 1940s. And, you know, a lot of people appreciated, his imagination. You know, when you scratch a rocket scientist in the United States, you're gonna find a science fiction fan, from way back.
You have to be.
Yeah, and old, you know, even, you know, Wernher von Braun, who, you know, who's the German rocket scientist that was brought over to head our space program, you know, with the paperclip stuff after World War II. You know, his main reason for getting into this whole thing was going to the moon. It always was. These other things were a sidetrack, you know, because he figured, well, it was better to build rockets for Hitler than to go to Dachau. Huh. And, you know, it's an interesting paradox. I don't know whether I ever told you the story, but my wife and I went over to Germany and we were touring what's left of the underground tunnels they had in Berchtesgaden, connecting the various places, because all the Nazis higher-ups had villas in this area. And they had built this place called Eagle's Nest for Hitler as a birthday present. It was Martin Bormann's idea. And what they did was they basically hollowed out the center of a mountain, and they put this building on top, and they built an elevator because the Führer, among his other achievements, was both claustrophobic and he had a fear of heights. Mm. So driving up the mountains was not a good thing for him. He didn't like that. So they built this elevator. It was the size of your living room and had mirrored walls to make it look even larger so he wouldn't get ill.
Okay.
Okay. And he described it. They did the whole thing in 9 months. Okay. They hollowed out a mountain. They built this villa that when you're on the villa, it looked like you were floating in the air above, because it was right on top of the mountain. There was nothing around it. Okay. And they said they built the whole thing in 9 months. And I said, gee, 9 months? I mean, that's awful short. How were they able to get the contractor to do that? And the guide smiled and said, well, it was either that or go to Dachau.
You had very good persuasive argument.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are both carrots and sticks as motivation.
Yeah. Well,
Ed Hamilton was one of the greats. We all recognize it, and it's nice that they had a little tribute to him here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had I'd seen that one.
Well, going back to our book. That we kind of slid off a little bit.
A little bit. We do that on occasion.
But, you know, still, we kind of on topic because, you know, Hamilton is in the book. We still had two more go. Greatheart, Philip Jose Farmer, and Tom Sutton. And that's the, he was in, this is number 6, this is another one of his stories. And then the last one is Galactic.
By author. Gumshoe.
Huh?
Yeah, Galactic Gumshoe.
I didn't say Galactic on here, but it's by Arthur Byron Cover and Ralph Reese. So that's a, here we go. On the back it says Galactic Gumshoe. It's the Art Cover's incredible mix of high fantasy heroics and low budget monsters and hard boiled fiction. Yeah, the reason I know the pronunciation is I got another one of his books that he wrote, and it looks like it's his cover, C-O-V-E-R, but it's Cover.
Aha, okay.
So, I made sure I got that name right. But,
pretty good.
Well, that's number 6. Number 7 is back to the novels, Ron Goulart's. Quest of the Gypsy novel is called The Eye of the Vulture. And on the back it says, an epic adventure of science fiction and mystery. Think of a quest, an epic quest, across the world you've never seen. Think of a hero, a wanderer, struggling to find his own destiny. Then place it, you know, it all in 2033, a future filled with the secrets of your past. Experience Quest of the Gypsy, an adventure where you must pit yourself against a maddening, 50-year-old puzzle. Good escapism that never loses its sense of direction or sense of humor. You can't lose. And, like I said, this is where, when you figure out the hero, it changes.
Aha, yeah.
And just, this one here, let's see now. Look like it's got quite a few. Oh yeah, they got quite a few illustrations in this one. So it's.
Yeah, Byron Price was always into graphics as an integral part of his stories and his work. I don't know whether you remember it, but he did a book on dinosaurs that came out in the 1980s.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, and they reprinted it not that long ago, about 10 years ago. 15 years ago now, as the new dinosaurs. But it was very well done, and you know, it used innovative coloring, innovative style for the pictures. So he was big at doing that. And if you notice, a lot of the pulp stories were very heavily illustrated. That's one reason why in some of the new magazines that we've had, some new pulp magazines that have been coming out in the last 10 years, they've had inside illustrations. Because that was an old thing that the pulps had. Every Doc Savage story had sets of illustrations in them. Same thing with The Shadow. And sometimes those illustrations were very helpful in fleshing out exactly what the author's vision was.
Okay. Well, going on to the last book in the series. This is one I believe you said you had?
Yes.
Volume 8. This. If this doesn't sell you guys, then I don't know what's going on. The very first story in Volume 8 is Seward, Michael Moorcock, and Chaykin. I mean, there you go.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Chaykin. You know, Michael Moorcock is, you know, he was beginning to get into his fantasy line at that time. He had started doing things in England, was just really getting into his stride.
Oh yeah,
and that was great. They had another story in there. Michael Reeves has a story with Camus.
Yeah, Camus.
Camus.
K A M U S.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's Hickman. Let's see who's. I'm trying to figure out. You know. Yeah. Then after that, you had mentioned earlier about Orion.
Mm-hmm.
Orion 2 with Bova and Russell. So I'll have to start rereading, you know. Then, of course, after that, we got Kamath 2. Reeves and Hickman. And I don't think there's really anything else that anybody'd be interested in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the last story would have to be one that it'd sell the book to any pulp fan around.
Yeah.
And it's Robeson by Mr. Grant. Kind of right. Actual Grant?
No, it's by Phil Farber.
226. Oh yeah.
This was a plan that Phil Farmer had for Weird Heroes number 9. All right, he was going to do two stories. He wanted to do a Doc Savage story for this issue that was done in the style of Maxwell Grant's The Shadows author,
right.
If you will, Walter Gibson. And then he was going to do a Shadow story written in the style of Lester Dent.
Right.
So he never got the chance to do the second one. This story about Robeson is written by, allegedly, a story written by Maxwell Grant. And in the story, we are introduced to a pastiche of Doc Savage called Dr. Fauve. Okay, Fauve is a French word for, that translates as Savage. And the reason why Dr. Fauve has the bronze color to his skin is because he is in an asylum being treated for alcoholism and liver failure. That's what gives him his bronze-colored skin. And he has an entire cast of characters from the asylum who are based upon the, Monk and Ham and the other beloved aides that Doc Savage had. And the Kenneth Robeson actually figures as a character in the story. He's the one who is narrating the story. That's why it's entitled Robeson.
Oh yeah. They call it the Grant Robeson Papers.
Right.
Now, like I said, that'd be worthwhile picking up just for that story alone. And I think a lot of people do for that story.
Oh yeah. That's the one, of all the stories in that particular issue, that is the one that I remember the most. And, heck, that was, what was the year of that one? What year did they publish that?
Okay, let me get back here. I even have the receipt from when I bought this thing.
Son of a gun.
I bought it, I didn't buy this. I mean, I bought this here, but the receipt, it said I paid 88 cents for it.
A little while ago.
Yeah, but, you know, I bought, because I only lived there like 5-6 years, but this is, it's the second printing. I thought I had it first. Second printing in December 77. The first printing was November 77.
Okay, so these books were coming out at a fairly frequent pace.
Much enough.
You know, 1975 to 1977, we have 8 issues. So that's 2 years. That's about quarterly.
Well, now the thing is, in the back, right after that story, he's advertising some other stuff that, you know, that Byron Press was doing. The first thing is Fixin' Illustrated, which was a lot of his digest size and, well, even larger size, too. But Fixin' Illustrated number one was Shlomo Raven. It's a digest size for $1. The number two is Starfawn, digest size, $1. Number three is Chandler. And it's, you know, they have a deluxe one for $4.95. I'm pretty sure I got the digest size. And then number four is The Son of Sherlock Holmes, which is the deluxe collector's edition, which is what I got. Different. And here's an introduction to Shlomo Raven. The 1940s come alive. Meet Shlomo Raven, private eye. He's a 3-foot fabulous talent with a rep rival Spade and Marlowe. This small detective takes on two of the biggest jobs in his career, the kidnapping of the four famous Farks brothers comedy team and the mysterious murder of the stagehand behind the scenes of the all-black musical version of Citizen Kane. Now, if that doesn't get your attention, nothing will.
Yeah.
Then we got the second one, Starfawn. Mysteriously endowed crew member of the Destiny encounters an alien civilization on a distant and seemingly dormant world. A sophisticated blend of Stephen Fabian's detailed art and Marie Severin's fabulous color. And story by Weird Heroes editor Byron Press, the first full-colored SF graphic novel. Then here comes the next one, Chandler. And, of course, you're going to recognize the name. The legendary graphic story artist and writer, and I'll let you do his name, Mr. S. Steranko.
Oh, Mr. Steranko? Yeah, Steranko. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I thought you knew that.
Okay. Yeah, it was him.
Okay, he returns with a full-color thriller set in New York, 1940. Red Tide pits hard-boiled Dick Chandler against a phantom murderer, an anti-heroic gumshoe in the atmosphere of steamy New York. Chandler has already been acclaimed as a classic of graphic story art. Over 200 illustrations compose a tense and intricate collage of a film noir and black mass conventions. Pretty cool. And then, of course, you got The Son of Sherlock Holmes. London, 1977. Word of a successor to the famed consulting detective is whispered in the back streets. On Charing Cross Road, an aging book dealer comes in contact with, I'm not even bothered trying to do that. And suddenly becomes involved in a 60-year-old crime. Abraham Moth and Isaiah Cohen, unlikely partners in the story of The Woman in Red by, Price and Reed. I mean, Reese. And that was, you know, I've got all those up there and they're pretty cool. So that's the 8 there. And the last two are The Guts and by Press, with the artwork by Gray Morrow and Michael Golden. And I've got a handful of pieces of artwork through there. And then the last of the novels is I, Alien, an illustrated novel. my Reeves, Austin. Let's see. Terry Austin. Very, very well known in comic books. He's got quite a bit of artwork. It's really nice.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the Weird Heroes anthologies were a springboard for a lot of the later-to-be well-recognized greats in comic art, and some of the writers as well.
And unfortunately, I mean, when you read them, it's like, after reading that there, you're just like, you're looking forward to more and more and more, and unfortunately, we don't get that.
Nope. I was always very disappointed that we didn't get the, the companion story of in the Grant Robson papers. I had been waiting for that for a long time, and it never materialized. But there are just some things that were not meant to be.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, Press had done other things later on, too. But it sounds like in some of the groups I've been in, with people who have known him professionally, mm-hmm. that he wasn't known for always paying his writers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I've been told. I mean, I'm just going by secondhand knowledge on that. But after reading his here, it always made me interested, anytime I saw his name, to pick it up. Because to me, it always meant that there's going to be something that's going to interest me in it.
Mm-hmm.
He did one comic graphic, series, Robin 3000, a two-issue series. It came out, I believe, in the 80s or something like that. Kind of in the prestige format style.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen that one or not, but kind of a Robin, a Batman and Robin version in the very distant future.
Oh, okay. I may have seen that.
You can find that thing pretty easy in the cheaper boxes, the 50-cent dollar boxes, stuff like that. Even though the cover price, I mean, it's a square-bound type, very nicely done. It's a blonde Robin. The Batman is killed off at the very beginning. And Robin is the main star. So, I mean, I've gotten it, read it a long time ago, probably reread it again. But, you mentioned some other stuff that's, that BVP has done. If you look, his visual productions is what he usually calls it. He's done quite a few different other stories and stuff. Pretty much all the way up to his, his death, was he said 2005?
Yeah.
Like I said, it made me interested in looking for anything he's done. And this is a series I've read over a few times, and after us talking about this here and looking at it, I'll be rereading these again real quick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would love to see that one on the Edmund Hamilton papers. Mm. That would be a very fascinating thing to read for me. Just because I really have enjoyed his work so much over the years. Give me something to look forward to, something to hunt down again.
Well, there's always the possibility of it coming out. Just keep on checking eBay or used bookstores. I found a few of these here, I think either on eBay or some of them I bought, I bought a couple of them when these coming out.
Really, with a lot of these classic works, now that we have electronic media that is so easy to deal with, it really, the future, I think, we're going to be seeing a lot of these materials being put on electronic media.
Exactly.
And stored in libraries. They're going to be made available to the public. A lot of this is going to come out into the public domain, I think. Not everything. When that happens, then it's always possible to get these anthologies and, put them into an electronic format and have them circulated around. There's no reason why, with our current technology, there's absolutely no reason why good pieces of literature and fiction should ever go out of print or become unavailable. There's always a way of keeping them alive. And, the new printing formats, we talked about this with Jean-Marc Lefissier from France. You know, now with his publishing group there, the Black Coats Press, they publish pretty much on demand. They don't have to maintain an inventory. They can get you a book in your hands. And, you know, now we have the Nooks and the Kindles and the Sony Readers and all these other devices that are becoming available to us. You know, the time is going to come when a lot of this stuff will just be there and we can download them.
Exactly. My friend Bruce Rosenberger, you know, I kind of kidded him because he recently picked up the iPad. Yeah, but he's been waiting for that thing for like 3 or 4 years now. I remember a few years back, the group that he and I are on, we've changed the name of the group a few times, but the whole group and I, we had discussed what we would like to see in a reader for like comic books or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And really, this iPad, you know, surpassed what everything we discussed. And Bruce was nice enough to make a little video when he picked it up. You can find it on the YouTube. Look for Comic Cast. Yeah, C-O-M. I'm going to preview do that. K-O-M-I-C-S-K-A-S-T. And Bruce does a really cool little video. He only did like 8 minutes. And it shows him opening up the thing and some of the things you can do with those iPads. And it's really a neat little thing. I mean, I never even thought I'd want one. My first somebody sent me a link to say, yeah, here, get yourself an iPad. Well, I don't want to spend no $500 on it.
Right.
I just want to do is, like you mentioned, like a Sony.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to, I tell my wife, I want a Sony book reader for my birthday coming up. And it's like, hey, I'll take the iPad now. But those Sony book readers are, the price is already dropping.
Oh, yeah.
And the quality is going up faster. You know, every time you turn around, there's a better one.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've wondered, on the iPad, my understanding is that it's not compatible with PDF. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that has got me a little skittish on the iPad. Because they were not going for the Flash program from Adobe. And there's an awful lot of things that are out there in PDF now. I mean, the government uses it as a standard way to put out documents, you know, for public distribution. Mature safety data sheets are on iPad. There's on PDF, rather. There's a whole series of things that you'd have to have. And I think the iPad will not really take off unless it supports some of the more common, formats.
Oh.
You know, this I think is a problem with the Kindle machine for Amazon, is that it has a proprietary format.
Exactly.
And whereas I think the folks over at Barnes and Nobles had done a smart thing by making their Nook compatible with Sony and with other formats that are already out there for the handheld devices. That's going to make things easier. You know, there's always a worry among the when the new technology comes out, there's always a worry that somehow the new technology is going to undermine sales of new books, and it never happens.
No, I mean, the thing is that we discussed it, you know, a long time ago that I agree with that digital will be the thing.
I think eventually all of that stuff's going to be there, and we'll be, and the way we view it is probably going to change. We're just in the process of learning what people like to use.
Exactly.
To view the material. But,
somebody who wants the actual print.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some people who still like the books. I enjoy the books, but I've read several things now on electronic media. Books I read on my computer. I don't have a handheld yet because I just don't know that there's anything out there yet that I want to commit to. Yeah. And, you know, if you're going to make that kind of investment, you really do have to commit to the particular device.
Well, it's like you mentioned, you know, on the Kindle, you know, you can only get from Amazon. Now, the thing is that my wife and I, we went over to Best Buy, and we was kind of checking out some stuff. And this one woman, she was who worked there was kind of giving us a good, lot of good information. Mm-hmm. And she was pretty much saying, yeah, the Nook is pretty nice. And you could read just, you know, this stuff from Barnes & Noble right there. You could download books from Barnes & Noble while you're sitting there and love them for free. They're not going to be the, you know, the big major sellers.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you know, the Sony and the Nook, you can get your PDFs. I mean, I'm the first to admit, I got a ton of stuff on my computer.
You know, yeah.
That a lot of them are stories that, realistically, the chances of them being reprinted in hard copy are none.
Mm-hmm.
For the simple reason that, you know, they're not really, you know, what the modern reader would be interested in. But just to be able to read it, it'd be nice. We've been sent books for us to, you know, to check out, you know, for our podcast.
Sure.
Because it's easier to say, hey, you know, here's a PDF of my book. See what you think. If you want, you know, want me to come on your show, you know, let me know.
Oh, yeah. And it's that's been a great resource. And, you know, the nice part about it is it's also somewhat portable.
Yeah. You can hold, one of those book readers can hold several hundred books.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I've done with some of them is I kind of take them to work with me. And if I get a break, I have my little flash drive.
Okay.
Plug it in, read it.
There you go.
You know, it doesn't take anything at all. You know, I think the time is coming when we're going to be seeing virtually all the major publishing is going to be electronic. And I think, you know, this, if you remember, we had a very similar problem when the computer first came out, and they were trying to protect the proprietary nature of various software. And it soon became an issue that they were putting so much protection on the software you couldn't use it anymore. Okay. And so a lot of companies started going bare. I think you're going to see a lot more of that happening. You know, the realization is going to come that the market is still going to be there. The market is not going to get flooded. They're still going to be making a fortune off of all these publications. But they need to look at the ease and the convenience of the reader. You know, there's a lot of material from earlier periods. You know, I have become more familiar in the last several years with material from various places in the 19th century that were precursors to our current heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about Nick Carter before, but there were Frank Reed. You know, even the old Tom Swift stories were precursors to some of the stories that we have now, the original Tom Swift stuff from the teens. And, you know, it's these things are of archival importance to us, and they need to be preserved. You know, I think, you know, John Mark is doing a tremendous thing by preserving some of these French science fiction stories that were not very well known to the American public, the English-speaking public, but which were very important in their day for, and you know, enlightening other people and giving people ideas. You know, not just Jules Verne, who was, I mean, only a fraction of Jules Verne's stuff has actually been translated into English, but a lot of these things, the author Rosny, the author of Quest for Fire, that you know, they made a film about it back in the 70s, which people were familiar with who had a lot. And I think, I forget who, I don't think that was a Kubrick film, but I do know that Anthony Burgess, the author, was involved with that one, Inventing New Languages. Rosny wrote several of these romances, not just that one. And these were all very interesting books and innovative books. So, you know, the one of the things about the Weird Heroes series, very brief time, okay, a span from 1975 to 1977. All right, eight just volumes, right?
Just a blink in time.
Okay, and look at the start it gave to a lot of these folks that would later on become very important in comics and in other forms of writing, okay? Talking about Ben Bova's Orion series, which continued for 30 years afterwards. You know, Phil Farmer, K. continuing his delving into the pulpish kind of characters in his own playful way. You know, this was a small series that I think had a big impact on the future of the graphics media and the story media. And you know, that's the reason why we wanted to highlight it today. You know, folks should look at that, and hopefully somebody will reprint some of these stories. You know, some of them, I have to admit, are dated. There was a lot of stuff in the 70s that, well, everybody was on drugs in the 70s, except me. So some things sounded better than others. But there's a lot of good stuff here. A lot of good stuff. And it's worthwhile getting this stuff back in print. I know, I believe the Grant Robeson stuff and the Great Heart Silver stuff has been reprinted in some of the reprints of Phil Farmer's material that they've been doing over at Subterranean.
Okay.
And, you know, so that stuff has been redone.
I think right now the first reprinting of the Great Heart Silver in the paperback,
mm-hmm.
that was one of the hardest ones I ever had to try to find. You know, that one reprint paperback.
Yeah.
I think it took me like 20 years to get a copy of it.
Wow. But, yeah, well, that shows you how interesting and important that whole character was.
And plus, it shows you, you know, how much, you know, our digital stuff would work. Because trying to find a lot of these books, I mean, where I'm living at now, I've got like maybe 2 used bookstores to work with.
Mm-hmm.
It's made me happy that when I've lived up in Kansas City area, that I've bought so many books.
Yeah.
I've got more books. I mean, if I read one book a day, it'd take me almost 3 years to read everything I have that's unread. Just my paperbacks and stuff.
Well, actually, I'm working on a third incarnation's bit of reading myself. But,
but a good...
Which my wife reminds me of every other day.
But there's a good example. I mean, just yesterday, I was at the new bookstores. And I saw a couple books. You know, I picked up a couple, and then I saw some other stuff. Which, you know, those oddball size paperbacks that they're putting out now, the really tall ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, fine, but I got my bookcase is customized for regular paperbacks, so it won't fit. It was a Robert B. Parker, Jesse Stone book, the very first in the series.
Huh.
And the thing is, it's $10 for the cover price. We're talking $10 for one book. All right. Now, if you had a digital and they put it out for $1, you'd be buying that and what all the other Jesse Stone books, right?
You bet.
If you didn't, you know.
Get the whole series.
And the thing is that the publisher could make more money selling it cheaper. A good example is when I do the comic book shows. You got a lot of people out there. They'll put out stuff at, say, whatever the price guide's saying, okay? Say, Joe's Superhero, number one, is $20 mint condition. Or, let's say, $5 mint condition. I have Joe's Superhero number one in my 50-cent boxes. They don't know if it's any good or not. Well, you're going to spend 50 cents faster than you will spend $5, right?
You bet.
To try out something different. And you'll be trying out other things to go with it. There, you could do with digital stuff. You're willing to pick up stuff.
Well, you know, the idea of getting the, you know, the whole Doc Savage corpus in electronic format. You know, something that, unfortunately, Black Mask was trying to do, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago. You know, not quite following the copyright guidelines.
Right.
But, you know, people will pay for that.
Exactly.
To have that and to have it available. It's the kind of thing that, you know, it's something that whose time has come. You know, there's a whole series of great weird fiction. I mean, the Jules de Grandin stories. There, you know, there's an enormous amount of the Harry Dixon stories. Not Harry Dixon, what is it? Sexton Blake stories, rather.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah.
4,500 of them.
Yeah.
Perry Rodin. Okay, Perry Rodin, the German science fiction hero, has been going on continuously from 1960 and is still going strong. Over 2,500 paperback stories. You know, unbelievable. You know, I, for one, I would love to get my hands on the entire Sun Co. run.
Right.
From the German pulps. You know, if I had that with the newer software that's coming, we could get, you can get it translated. You could read it. Yep. And, you know, there are 150 of the Sun Co. stories that we know of, those that had been published, and there's nobody to, there's no way to read them right now. Because, you know, they're republishing them in German. I think they're up to probably about the third, the fourth or fifth volume of the Sun Co. stories. But they're, you know, almost impossible to find. You can't get them elsewhere.
Well, if anybody should be the publisher for the translated copies, it should be you.
Yeah, well, you know, that's, you know, it's, you have to remember that the reason why I got involved with the Sun Co. character at all was out of the frustration of not having the character
right.
available. So I said, the heck with it, I'll make up my own stories, and I did. And hopefully people enjoy them, and that's the whole reason why I did it. Well, you know, I think we've been going on for a little while now. How far are we into it?
About an hour and 45, and like I said, we covered some stuff out there. It's like, we all do one of these days, and it's just talk nothing but digital.
Yeah.
You know, just have a recording on that.
Not a bad idea. Yeah. Because I'm sure that there are people out there who are starting to get tired of listening to us.
Yeah, we might as well just go ahead and close it down, because we finished talking about Weird Heroes. And like I said, if you can find them, grab them up.
Check them out. I think you're going to find some very good stuff there.
And I think it's a great introduction to some great writers, you know, some classic writers. People always think, do I really like a Philip Bay Farmer? Well, you read this here and you can find out, well, yes I do, or no I don't. But the thing is in the anthologies, there's others that you can find out if you like or not. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these I've never read before. I mean, I knew when I got these here, I knew Philip Bay Farmer, I knew Harlan Ellison, but I've never read any of them. And it did get me my curiosity into them. So stuff like that is worth picking up just to find out if you like it or not. And this is a series that should be reprinted. So hopefully we'll see it someday. We don't know. But like I said, I think we need to close it down before they kind of wonder what we're talking about.
Yeah, before they come and drag us away.
All right, well. Make sure and listen to us next week, because we're going to have a very special show next week. That's all we're going to say, just in case we don't get it next week.
Show up.
But if everything works out, it's going to be a really fun show.
Yes, indeed.
All right, well.
And hopefully we'll stay on time.
Yeah, why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah, there's no fun in that.
Yeah. All right, well. Thanks for listening to us and putting up with us for all this time. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye now.